3 seconds, 2 seconds, 1 second, blast off!
The age that we have just left, the 45 years since the end of the Second World War, was overshadowed by a strange partnership between science and fear. It began with a weapon created by scientists that threatened to destroy the world. But then a group of men who were convinced they could control the new danger began to gain influence in America. They would manipulate terror. To do so, they would use the methods of science. Out of this would come a new age, free from the chaos and uncertainties that had led to terrible wars in the past.
They believed, I think honestly at the beginning and fraudulently at the end, that they could create a better world and have control over this process of recreating the world through their science and their mathematics, because it all sounded so damn rational and so damn reasonable as to be unassailable.
Their opportunity came on October the 4th, 1957, when the Soviet Union suddenly launched the first ever satellite, Sputnik.
It was amazing to the American people that here was this spacecraft up in the sky, and suddenly the American people realized that the Soviet Union was not, as they were supposed to be, a backward power that was capable of providing us with caviar and ballet companies, but had no business being up in space. It was shocking to find out we'd been so wrong about them. It was shocking to discover that perhaps we had something to fear.
2 months later, the Russians struck again. Sputnik 2 carried into space a dog called Laika.
Change to Laika.
As the Soviet Union flaunted its success, American politicians panicked.
If Russia wins dominance of this completely new area, well, I think the consequences are fairly plain. Probable Soviet world domination.
A sense of vulnerability swept America, for Laika could just as easily have been a nuclear warhead. To the military, it was a nightmare. Russia was their enemy, yet they had no idea how to defend themselves against this new weapon that might descend suddenly from outer space. But 3,000 miles away on the California coast, scientists believed they had the answers. They worked at the RAND Corporation. RAND stood for Research and Development. It was the first scientific think tank. RAND was funded by the Air Force, but staffed by young academics who believed the scientific method could help bring the Cold War back under America's control.
You're here at RAND in Santa Monica, California, on the Pacific Ocean, where groups of engineers, scientists, mathematicians, political scientists all came together to begin working on problems originally of national defense and national security. The principal issue they were dealing with was trying to understand the future of American security in the nuclear age. It involved questions of technology. What would technology offer? How could it be harnessed to serve America's security? Science of the rigorous mathematical sort.
The techniques that they were developing were generally categorized as systems analytic techniques. And what this consisted of was getting an enormous mathematical model that could be calculated thanks to the advent of these high-speed computers.
Next, we can store a program to compute the required factors.
We had a combination of technologists, the economists, mathematicians, who could piece all of these disciplines together and feed their inputs into this huge, complex mathematical model, it meant that the world could be understood to a degree where it could be calculated and predicted. And that's what these systems analysts proceeded to do.
To the scientists at RAND, the Cold War was a totally new system of conflict. Past experience and politics were no help in predicting how the other side would behave. They turned instead to a method of predicting behavior in uncertain situations, the theory of games. It had been developed by the famous mathematician John von Neumann, who had worked at RAND. In the 1920s in Berlin, he had watched poker games and seen how each player's strategy depended on what he thought the other side would rationally do. Von Neumann had shown how to give numerical values to the different choices and so decide on the best move.
It was seen like a game. A game in which there were rational players and in which each side had certain information about the capabilities of the other side. The notion of Kriegsspiel evolved at RAND, which was the game of chess in which you don't see the opponent's pieces. You have two chess boards, each complete, with a blind between them. And you have to presume from indirect information where the opponent's chess pieces are and then make the best judgment you can to get more information.
RAND strategists studied every piece of information they could find about the Soviet Union. They even wrote their own operational code of the Politburo and commissioned the famous anthropologist Margaret Mead to study the Russian attitude to authority. From this came complex mathematical models that showed the Air Force the best possible moves. But in the process, the idea of the Cold War as a political conflict that could be resolved was fading away. It became instead a mechanical system in which all parts worked according to rational laws, and that included the enemy. So the strategist's job was to keep it balanced in equilibrium. The most influential figure at RAND was Albert Wellstetter, a mathematical logician. He was also a devoted fan of modern architecture and abstract design, and a close friend of the famous architect Le Corbusier. Wellstetter saw the system of conflict as dangerously unstable. He was convinced the Soviet Union might attack, not because it wanted to, but because the rational logic of the system would force it to pull the trigger first.
I drew the analogy with the Western gun duel. The gunman and the sheriff were not necessarily morally, were not morally equivalent in any sense, but they each might find themselves in a position where they'd had to draw first in order to survive. And this would be a rational act if they found themselves in that position. So I wanted to design a posture where it would never make sense for an adversary, in his own terms, to attack.
Wellstetter invented what were to become the familiar icons of the nuclear age. He proposed that hundreds of missiles should be protected in concrete silos underground. Fleets of bombers were to be in the air 24 hours a day, controlled by a system he designed called Failsafe. The aim was to convince the Soviets that if they attacked, America would always have enough missiles left to destroy them in return. The Cold War would become safer by stabilizing what Wellstetter called the delicate balance of terror.
There are some instances where you may be ahead of us. For example, in the development of the thrust of your rockets for the investigation of outer space. There may be some instances, for example, color television, where we're ahead of you. But in order for both of us, to benefit,
as America's politicians became increasingly intimidated by the Soviets, the strategists exercised a restraining influence. They argued that the enemy was dangerous, but rational. It was not a satanic monster that had to be destroyed.
We have the resources, intelligence, and courage to make the correct decisions. There were real dangers of the subversion or attack on, more military attack on Europe. Our aim was to design a more stable balance.
But the rise of the strategists was only part of the changes brought about by the Cold War.
After Sputnik and the Cold War started, then they started developing all of these missiles. All the other companies would bid for them and build them, and they'd bring them out here and test them. From, like the Patriot, 16 years, and it's been tested, still testing it. They're adding to it now to make it reach out further. Here is the cruise missile. It was here. That was the meanest looking one that I've ever seen. To see something like that was out of this world, was unreal.
Lift off.
In 1961, the influence of the men from RAND increased dramatically. The new president, John F. Kennedy, turned to them to impose order, not only on nuclear strategy, but on the arms race, which was threatening to run out of control. Kennedy was convinced the scientific method was the key to solving the problems of modern industrialized societies.
I believe the Soviet Union is first in outer space. We may have made more shots, but the size of their rocket thrust and all the rest. You yourself said to Khrushchev, you may be ahead of us in rocket thrust, but we're ahead of you in color television. I think that color television is not as important as rocket thrust.
Leading members of the RAND Corporation were asked to become the aides of the new Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara. McNamara had previously run the Ford Motor Company and used systems analysis to rationalize production. Now he told the strategists to do the same with America's defense. They were no longer advisors to the military, they had become the masters. But they had hardly begun work when they received some astonishing news. A new reconnaissance satellite showed that far from having 600 missiles, as the Air Force had claimed, the Soviets had only 4. It was severely embarrassing for the strategists, because the Air Force figures had been the basis of much of their work.
The Air Force intelligence inputs were mainly parochial, and they were designed to make out the enemy, principally the Soviets, at their very worst, because if they did that, the Air Force would get ever so many billions of dollars to build more airplanes, more missiles, more everything. And so these analysts were being misled from the very beginning.
For years, the Air Force had been showing slides of Russian monasteries and war memorials, claiming they were missile silos in disguise. The awkward question now was whether RAND studies were equally fictitious. But the strategists were undeterred. The Russians had fewer missiles, and the satellite showed where they were. So it would be possible, if a nuclear war happened, to mount selective strikes, and thus control and even win the conflict.
This was combating the notion that there was only one big spasm kind of war, and once things started, all you did was shut your eyes, close your ears, fire everything. I was once doing a study in the Pentagon with the people who were responsible for getting all the data about nuclear detonations anywhere on the continent. And I asked the question, how do you tell when the war is over? And it looked as if the question had never occurred to them before. And I thought, well, this is important, that somebody must be attending to how the war will be ended as well as simply to how to start it efficiently.
Under the strategists' new plans, Soviet military targets would be annihilated first. America's remaining missiles would be held back to threaten Russia's cities and force the Soviet government into submission. The most notorious proponent of these plans was Hermann Kahn. He had left RAND and set up his own think tank, the Hudson Institute, near New York. He was convinced a controlled nuclear war was possible.
Just because you go to war, that itself may be an irrational act, or may not. But even if you irrationally decide to go to war, it doesn't mean you have to fight it in a wildly irrational fashion.
Many people feel that even if they survive a nuclear war, that things are going to be so awful and life is going to be so destroyed everywhere that they'd actually rather be dead.
That's a almost completely standard reaction, and it's really a reaction to try to prevent thinking about the subject. And I make a comment which always gets me in a great deal of criticism. Let me make it anyway. Objective studies literally indicate that the post-war environment, while hostile to human life, more hostile than the pre-war environment, will not be so hostile as to, quote, preclude normal and happy lives.
The Institute is now deserted, but in the early 60s it was full of men and women working out what to do if the worst happened. Cities on both sides were given precise values. Then scenarios were constructed, like equations, showing what to do in any eventuality.
There's an accident. We drop a bomb on Kiev. It was a fluke. We didn't mean to. The Russians believe we didn't mean to. Then there's a negotiation about where can we drop a bomb on something that's of equal value of Kiev. If we drop the bomb, we can stop now. You know, if we destroy something equal, you've got a sort of a status
quo. But if you escalate, if you go from our equivalent of Kiev to
New York,
our equivalent of Moscow, it's a very big escalation.
In a controlled nuclear war, populations of cities would become like pawns in a game of bargaining with nuclear weapons. So the strategists persuaded America's leaders to take civil defense seriously.
Now that we're convinced that Russia can deliver a devastating weapon here to the San Fernando Valley, and that the majority of the radioactivity is short-lived, how can we protect ourselves against this particular hazard? We must have concentrated...
Herman Kahn believed that America's cities would have to be evacuated two or three times a decade as America played brinkmanship with the Soviet Union. Everyone would have to be taught to think rationally about nuclear war.
I can remember growing up having dinner table discussions about, let us assume something happens. We go down in our bomb shelter. We can support 6 or 10 or 12 people in the shelter. The neighbors start banging on the door. Let us in, let our children in. Who do we let in? That's sort of unthinkable when you're 10 years old or 9 years old. I mean, that's what I remember growing up discussing things like that, because it was possible. And if it was possible, it was worthy to talk about, you know, rather than just saying, well, you throw up your hands and say it's unthinkable.
These analysts were human beings. They were no ordinary human beings. They had more than a smattering of megalomaniacs, Herman Kahn being one of them, Albert Wolstetter, another megalomaniac. It was this feeling that they could gain control and a huge degree of power by doing these studies. And so these analysts indeed achieved their grandiose dream. They were in full control.
Then, as if on cue, a crisis occurred that seemed the perfect test for these theories. In October 1962, America discovered the Soviet Union was sighting nuclear missiles in Cuba. The question was how to force them to stop. To the strategists, it was a clear opportunity for their scenarios. While journalists waited outside, President Kennedy's cabinet met to decide whether to attack Cuba. Their discussions were recorded. The tapes show a group of men facing the reality of a nuclear crisis. As the strategists had told them, it was a game of bargaining. But confronted by the need for action, they found they had no idea how the other side would respond to any move they made. They weren't even sure if the other side was rational.
It seems to me almost certain that any one of these forms of direct military action will lead to a Soviet military response of some type, some place in the world.
But they may be thinking that they can either bargain Berlin and Cuba against each other, or that they could provoke us into a kind of action in Cuba which would give an umbrella for them to take action with respect to Berlin. If they could provoke us into taking the first overt action, then the world would be confused and they would have what they would consider the justification for making the move somewhere else. For the first time, I'm beginning really to want
As the crisis escalated, the prospect of nuclear war became very real. If it happened, the strategists' elaborate plans were supposed to offer the president ways to control it.
But I must say, I was scared to death that we were going to get ourselves in a nuclear exchange. And I wasn't sure until the final culmination of the thing that we were going to escape that. I think we took a hell of a chance myself.
If that nuclear exchange had happened, do you think it could have been controlled in the way the strategists argued?
No, I think we had testimony from these characters by day and night on how do you contain a nuclear exchange. I never believed any of it.
Half or three quarters of Los Angeles has been destroyed. Well, how are you going to continue to live?
Well, the first thing we have to recognize is that if half of Los Angeles is destroyed, maybe 80-90% of the people will be dead, and there will be fewer mouths to feed, and those of us who will survive will have more water and food to divide up.
Well, isn't this a very good argument from a purely selfish point of view of not wanting many people to make shelters?
This is true, but on the other hand, those of us who have been building shelters, we believe for the most part that if we as citizens do something to demonstrate that we are prepared to withstand an attack, the Russians or whoever it is will be less likely to launch an attack against us.
In the end, President Kennedy ignored any idea of controlled war. Instead, he told the Russians that if they launched just one missile from Cuba, he would retaliate with America's entire arsenal. To the strategists, this threat was irrational and humiliating.
My only recollection is of one of disappointment. I mean, President Kennedy indicated that the United States had the capability to engage in massive retaliation, which led several of us to wonder why he had used this particular language and why he hadn't gone to what at least we thought of as the more powerful and rational approach to deterrence. It seemed to me that it would be utter folly for us to go in what one of my colleagues, Herman Kahn, called a wargasm and try and destroy everything we could, because in effect, that would sign the death warrant of the United States.
The Russians backed down, and America celebrated. But Cuba had shown, like a flash of lightning on a dark night, how the Cold War really worked, through fear, not reason. Robert McNamara began to back away from the elaborate plans for controlling nuclear war. Yet the strategists remained influential. Politicians found their rational approach irresistible.
I think the Americans have made a kind of theology about using scientific means to solve political problems. The belief that this is a kind of substitute for religion, that you turn to these mysterious forces which we've now begun to harness for the first time, and we can use them, and therefore we become a master of everything, and we don't have to worry about other things.
The Great Society is a place where every child can find knowledge to enrich his mind and to enlarge his talent. It is a place where leisure is a welcome chance to build and reflect, not a feared cause of boredom and restlessness. It is a place where the city of man serves not only the needs of the body and the...
In 1964, President Johnson promised a new approach to government, which would solve deep-rooted social problems, such as poverty. Its architects were to be the systems analysts from RAND.
President Johnson had a vision of a society which would be glorious. And he saw in the analytical strength, the rationality that was being applied in some of the military problems, an aid, a force that could be applied also in the civilian areas. And so we were apostles. We were apostles of rationality. We were to go out and apply those techniques and methods of thinking to civilian problems, to bring to bear systematic, rational thinking to them. And we believe that they were solvable problems. They were not insoluble.
On the president's orders, many of the men who had gone from RAND to the Pentagon now moved on into other areas of government. They had become all-powerful courtiers in an age of reason. their methods were being used to build a better world in America. As their power increased, so did their ambitions. Their techniques, they said, could even predict the future.
Control, 20% probability. So one, yes, here's the unlikely event that became true, and I just go on through the others the same way.
This is not a crap game. It's a serious game. Rolling the dice is Dr. Olaf Helmer of the RAND Corporation. He is conducting a simulation exercise. A panel of experts has studied a list of possible 21st century developments, from personality control drugs to household robots. They have estimated the numerical probability of each. The current fascination of a new intellectual breed, the futurists.
So we wind up with a world which has the following features. We have fertility control, 100-year lifespan, controlled thermonuclear power, continued automation, genetic control, man-machine symbiosis, household robots, wideband communications, opinion control, and continued urbanization.
I would guess in 100, certainly less than 200 years, if things go at all well, 90-95% of the world's people will be living at higher than the current American standards of living. Young men will go from everywhere poor, everywhere in danger of hunger, starvation, to a life in which the technology largely insulates you from nature.
But at the very moment when the men from RAND were promising America a utopia, their whole approach was about to meet its nemesis. In 1965, Lyndon Johnson began a bombing campaign of North Vietnam. The targets were chosen for their psychological value, pawns in a game of persuading the communists to withdraw from the South. It was inspired by the work of RAND's leading exponent of game theory, Thomas Schelling.
It was a war in which we were attempting to intimidate an enemy into discontinuing what he was doing, in which it was believed that if you made it painful enough for the North Vietnamese, they would call off their campaign. So I think there may have been plenty in my writings that people thought applied to this kind of war, because this was a vicious, violent bargaining process. And the effort was to convince the other side that we could tolerate more pain and damage than they could.
But the communists did not behave in a rational way and retreat. Reluctantly, the strategists and the Pentagon agreed to send thousands of American troops to Vietnam.
Glory, glory, what a hell of a way to die! Glory, glory, what a hell of a way to die!
By now, the systems and numbers approach dominated the Pentagon. McNamara's whiz kids were convinced that the battle against the Viet Cong could be managed in a rational, scientific way. Indeed, they could see no other way.
The problem with the Vietnam War was that it was not a war for territory. What American policymakers needed, what the Pentagon needed, was some way of how do you tell if we're winning or not? In the absence of being able to take Hanoi or something like that, they had to find other indicators. And what came out of that was a whole array of statistics. It ranged from the body count down to number of missions flown, number tonnage of bombs dropped, number of enemy structures destroyed, tonnage of food captured from the enemy.
This is a chart that was used by one of the think tanks to demonstrate how to neutralize an enemy village, showing a flow of how action can be taken to neutralize enemy force. Is this village loyal to the belligerent? Consider the next village. Is this village loyal to the opponent? No. Based on reliable information, what does this village perceive as its major problem? It's almost like a game of Monopoly, isn't it? To Mr. McNamara and his brain trust of whiz kids, this was probably equal to the U.S. Constitution. It was the ultimate document.
If one thinks of political and military aggression from...
I will tell you, for example, that we long sessions that we used to have on Vietnam, when McNamara would be urging us a certain measure, and the president would say, well, Bob, what do you think the chances of success are? Oh, he would say, I think it's 55% and 45% failure. And I would speak up and say, Bob, are you sure it isn't 47% and 42%? You know, I mean, this was a frame of mind. And nothing was ever expressed except in quantitative terms as far as McNamara was concerned, and he spoke for the whole Defense Department.
Let me give you an example of the way the numbers worked. I happened to be on a patrol in late spring, early summer of 1967, where we spotted, observed a Vietnamese national some hundreds of meters away from us, running away from us. And standard procedure at that time was to, you could fire on anybody running away from you. When we got to the body, we discovered that it was an unarmed, older woman, 55, 60 years old. And in the intelligence summary that I prepared the next day, I put in exactly what happened. By the time that that report reached the division level, that dead woman had become an ageless, genderless Viet Cong with a Chinese Communist grenade. And these numbers, these reports, these statistics directly obscured the reality and presented a picture that was 180 degrees removed from reality. And yet when you take all those numbers and dump them in the Pentagon, those guys sit there and they count up the numbers and they can go, we're winning.
In 1967, Robert McNamara resigned in failure. Before he went, he made a speech in Montreal. He ended it by asking, who is man? Is he a rational animal? If he is, then the goals can be achieved. But if he isn't, then there is little point in making the effort. McNamara had been the patron of the strategists. Without him, much of their power disappeared. They and their think tanks became targets for the mass protests against the war.
Hundreds of people protested and marched up the driveway and planted crosses in the front yard of the Institute. And it made me and many of us here very angry, because they were making assumptions about what we thought, and they wouldn't even check.
They thought we were warmongers up here. There's no question about that.
They offered us jobs to go other places. When we would leave the driveway for lunch, they'd stop and offer us jobs if we'd leave Hudson Institute. None of us ever did.
America's politicians had originally been attracted to the strategists because they promised a rational, controllable world. But in Vietnam, their methods had been used to create a fiction. The scientific approach had been corrupted to preserve the politicians' power.
When we started all this systems analysis business, all these many, many years ago, we stepped through the looking glass, where people did the weirdest things, had the most perverse kind of logic imaginable, and yet claimed, you know, to have the most precise understanding of everything, and would give these perversely, superbly rational, you know, logical explanations as to why they were doing all of these perverse and irrational things. That was the world that's always existed. It's always been a perverse, irrational world. That was the world that these systems analysts stepped into. That's in the mirror. They should have stayed on the right side.
What they left behind was mad. Mutual assured destruction. A giant system of nuclear defense with the two sides locked together, watching each other for the slightest move. But by the mid-70s, it seemed to have become an end in itself.
We are part of the Aerospace Defense Command. We want to maintain surveillance of all these satellites to continually know where they are, and also to determine if a new satellite is up there.
Why is that information required?
Well, you got me.
The system of deterrence had begun as rational. It now seemed a dangerous trap. If either side decided to attack, it would mean the end of the world. Then a politician came to power who believed that this was just what the Soviets were about to do.
Ladies and gentlemen, the next president of the United States of America, Ronald Reagan!
In 1980, on the campaign trail, Reagan came face to face with the delicate balance of terror.
He visited NORAD, the North American Air Defense Command, to see what they did. And he went and they showed him all these magnificent warning systems. And then he said, after you get the first warning, what do you do? And they said, well, we follow these incoming missiles a little further and keep track of them better. And then he said, what do you do? And they said, well, we follow them further and keep track of them better. And he kept asking, and the answer he wanted to hear was, and finally we shoot them down. But they never got to that. Because, in fact, there was no missile defense. We had missile warning, but we had no missile defense. And he thought, like a lot of people thought, that that's kind of crazy. I mean, that's got to be fixed. We've really got to work on defense. If science can do all these wonderful things that it's done in the past, it surely can accomplish this if we will just unleash it.
But this was an age of disillusion with science. And the people who came forward with the solution the president wanted were zealots. Scientists like the inventor of the hydrogen bomb, Edward Teller. He had long dreamt of a defensive missile shield in space. A lobby group was formed that proposed such a defense could be assembled using the new space shuttle. It was led not by strategists, but by two science fiction writers.
We ended up as the kitchen cabinet on space and military technology. We had access to the president, and because we had that access, nobody refused an invitation to come to the meetings, what it amounted to. So we ended up with a bunch of four-star generals and captains of industry and the entire military-industrial complex of the United States in Larry Niven's living room. And in fact, Jim Ransom pointed out that one RPG through the plate glass window of Larry's thing would have pretty well crippled the United States technologically for 20 years. He was probably right. And science fiction writers, by the way, turned out to be very key to this process because they could write the documents that were understandable by the president.
Let me share with you a vision of the future which offers hope. It is that we embark on a program to counter the awesome Soviet missile threat with measures that are defensive. Let us turn to the very strengths in technology that spawned our great industrial base and that have given us the quality of life we enjoy today. What if free people could live secure in the knowledge that we could intercept and destroy strategic ballistic missiles before they reached our own soil or that of our allies? My fellow Americans, I ask for your prayers.
Many of Reagan's cabinet, including his Secretary of State, had no advance warning of this proposal. As they watched in the White House that night, they quickly discovered this was not going to be a magic escape from the cycle of terror, just another twist.
During dinner, I happened to sit next to the then Secretary of State, George Shultz. And he said, is it possible to put a laser up in the sky with sufficient power to knock out a Russian ICBM? And I said, yes, it is possible. Well, he said, doesn't that really make a tremendous difference? I said, not necessarily. If I were the Russians, I would be thinking about carrying a mirror, and you shine your high-powered light at me that can destroy me, and you'll get it back in your face. Well, then, it's no good. What you're saying, this is an offense versus defense battle that has always gone on. For every offensive weapon, there's a defense. And then when there's a defense, there's an offense that beats the defense. And this goes on into infinity. And this is just some more of the same.
From arrows to rockets, this city built its fame. It's known.
After Reagan announced the laser was coming to Oro Grande, it was a Cold War all over again. They were moving it out here to intercept any big, small, or bombs that would come in to our properties.
It became known as Star Wars. Dramatic tests of different high-powered lasers were shown on American television. But behind the scenes, there were serious problems, especially with the grandiose promises of Edward Teller working at the Livermore Laboratory.
There were a small number of X-ray laser tests done underground in Nevada, but these tests were failures as weapons. There's no way could this thing have been made into a weapon for use in space. In that sense, they were failures. Yet in spite of this, Edward Teller wrote glowing letters to high government officials under President Reagan.
This X-ray laser is a remarkable invention. And I am not allowed to tell you more. I wish I would be allowed, and I think I should be allowed to tell you more, because the Soviets know about it anyway, in detail.
Teller wrote, for instance, a single X-ray laser module the size of an executive desk, which applied this technology, could potentially shoot down the entire Soviet land-based missile force if it were to be launched into the module's field of view. Now, this kind of statement is absolute blithering nonsense. It is science fiction. It's fantasy. I also think it's dishonest. It was a corruption of science technology to promote a fantastic idea that could not ever work.
But to those who had first persuaded the president, such problems were irrelevant.
Yeah, blow him away. Just kill him,
yee-haw! As it became apparent that the Soviet Union was close to collapse, they claimed that all along the idea had really been to bankrupt the evil empire.
I love these little machines. Got it! Son of a gun, it worked. Mm-hmm. You know, we were putting together a... We used all the rational analysis we could to put together a strategy to bring down the evil empire, and we did it! It happened!
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It literally took a set of scientific concepts, turned them into a policy, got it adopted, and used it to bring about, in my judgment, one of the key events of the 20th century. Science did that. It brought down the evil empire.
Challenger, they're heading downrange.
There were many reasons why the Soviet Union finally collapsed, but few people would count Star Wars among them. For 40 years, the world had been frozen by the two superpowers locked in conflict. The men from RAND had seen this as a system simple enough to control with the methods of science. When America's adversary crumbled, that simple world was replaced by complexity and chaos, far beyond the reach of their abstract theories.
We here at RAND believe that the last 40 years, the period from the end of World War II until 1989, was really a very unique period in history. Most of the history of Europe or of the world has involved shifting balances of power and constant warfare, whereas the last 40 years, the balance of power was fairly rigidly frozen. And now we're seeing the balance of power is going to now become more complex the way it was before in the 18th century and 17th century.
Suddenly, the Soviet Empire collapsed. What had kept me going through all these many, many years of professional activity disappeared. There was no enemy. We've returned to what we never left, human normalcy. And we're going to be in for more surprises. I don't know what. We're going to be in for more wars. Of what kind? Of what magnitude? I don't know.
The strategists were part of an age that believed political problems could be solved by the application of knowledge. Their success in preventing Armageddon seemed proof that it worked. But they were lucky enough to inhabit a world that was simple, frozen by the deadlock between the superpowers. That odd moment in history is over, and with it has gone the optimistic faith that the world was being changed for the better.
We are about to take off on the highway of tomorrow. Stand by.